Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Carl.
Welcome to A Life in Biography.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to be talking today about your biography of L. Christie. Before we talk about him specifically, I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself, how you pronounce your name, and how you got interested in L. Christie.
Okay. Well, my name is Mark Carney. That's how I pronounce my last name. Some people say Kearney, but it's not. It's Carney. I am a longtime journalist. I teach journalism and some other writing courses at Western University here in London, Ontario, Canada. And I've been doing that for about 20 years or so. I have written other books, co-written other books with a colleague of mine here in Canada. But my L. Christie biography is my first solo book. I would say about more than 20 years ago, I was actually browsing the shelves of one of the libraries at the university, and I came across a guy, a silent film director by the name of John S. Robertson. He had a fairly long career in Hollywood, and he was from London, Ontario, and I'd never heard of him. And I started doing a little research on him. And the research that I started doing on him kind of led me to L. Christie. And I hadn't heard of L. Christie either. And I thought it was kind of unusual that these two guys had successful directing careers in the silent era of Hollywood and into the talking sound pictures. And I found that there was a little bit more about Christie, and that Christie had maybe a slightly higher profile and a longer career. And I started looking into Christie, and that's really how I got to do the book.
Ah. So tell us a little bit now about Christie himself, mm-hmm. and where you found your material on him.
Yeah, so I found some material here in London at the public library system. They had a few bits of information about him. And I also got in touch fairly early on with a grand or great nephew of his who lived out in the San Francisco area, and talked to him on a couple of occasions. I found that Christie was, as the book title suggests, a pioneer. He was really the first guy to go to Hollywood and set up and start making movies in Hollywood in 1911. He and his group of actors and sort of backstage people went out there. They found a location in a tavern that was for rent. They set up their studio there, and almost immediately started making pictures. This would have been in October, late October of 1911. So I always like to say that all of Hollywood movie history really starts with L. Christie, because he was the first one in the town of Hollywood to make movies. There were a couple of other directors out there in the Los Angeles area around that time, but Christie was the first. And he primarily made comedy films. The studio was the Nestor Company. It was based in New Jersey, New York. And they made three films a week when they first got out there. There was a drama, a comedy, and a Western. And they churned them out.
Yeah.
And used all the actors they had for all the movies, dressed them up in different ways. So there was, as I got looking into Christie, there was a lot of material about him and his studio in the trade magazines of the day, certainly through the teens and definitely into the 20s. So there was a lot there. One of the other real bonuses, I think, for me for doing this book was that I found out that he had his papers, for lack of a better word, were in a collection at the University of Wyoming in what they call the American Heritage Center. And they have all kinds of weird and wonderful things out there. But one of Christie's actresses had a lot of his papers. And when she died, I guess she donated them to the American Heritage Center. So there were a lot of scripts and scenarios and a lot of studio notes, and they had kind of an in-house magazine that they would put out every couple of months in the 20s, where they, you know, I guess sent to distributors and anybody else that was interested, talking about the movies they were making. Al would have usually a column or two where he would pontificate about the state of movies and why they made the kinds of movies they did. So there was a lot of good material there. And then it was, from that point, it was really finding other people, experts to talk to. Those were sort of the main sources.
Sure. Now, people have heard, of course, of Chaplin and Keaton and Max Sennett. Right. Why haven't they heard more about Al Christie?
Yeah, that's the big question. In the book, I speculate a little bit, and I also get some of the other historians to comment on it. Everybody seems a little bit puzzled by it, but there are some thoughts. First of all, Chaplin and Keaton, I think, are in a level of their own. You know, they made very popular movies. They concentrated mostly on feature films, which were probably the most popular in the 20s and beyond. Christie was more, he did feature films, but he was more of a fan of the short films, the 10-minute, the 20-minute type films. He was a real believer in them. He made good movies, and he was well-known and well-respected at the time. He was pretty good at promoting himself in the studio, but perhaps not as well as maybe Sennett or Chaplin and Keaton. And I think the other thing, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more, Christie was a real believer in situation comedies.
Yes.
And, you know, movies with a story and characters, and they get into some kind of scenario and they have to figure out things and things go wrong, et cetera, et cetera. He wasn't a big fan of slapstick. He did have slapstick in his films, for sure, but not in the way that Sennett did. And I think in some ways, the audience loved the slapstick. I mean, it was easy to laugh at things. It was a universal kind of humor. And Christie's was more, perhaps more of a North American style, that if you knew what life was like in you know, America, Canada, whatever, those films, you could see the characters doing things that maybe a lot of people did. But it maybe doesn't have the universality of slapstick. And maybe over the decades, as time goes by, you can still laugh at somebody sort of in a car chase or getting a pie in the face or whatever, but maybe the subtleties of situation comedy don't, I don't know, don't hold up as long or as well or as for wide an audience.
Well, that's, I was about to use the word subtleties, and I like that because people do not necessarily associate the word subtlety with situation comedy.
Right.
They still think of situation comedy as jokes, right, sort of, you know, broad action, even if it's not slapstick. And one of the things I noticed by watching one of Christie's movies on YouTube was you really have to watch it. You have to pay attention.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he has, you have to sort of keep a track of the characters and who's who and how's that person connected. And he doesn't have a lot of dialogue on the sort of titles that come with silent movies, but still probably more than a slapstick type movie would. And yeah, you got to kind of follow the story. And of course, one of the things that Christie seemed to like was he liked to have stories about, usually it was a young couple. They were often, you know, college educated, or they had some kind of, you know, good job or whatever. And there was often like either a mistaken identity, or he was certainly a big fan of cross-dressing in movies. He had his, you know, his male characters would dress up as women as part of the plot, or women dressing up as men as part of the plot, which I think is kind of a delightful, almost more of a current feel in some ways than maybe movies from 100 years ago would have. But at the same time, you're right, it's a little more maybe complicated to watch movies like that.
Before we I want to say a something about his certain subjects that he treats and so on and ask you about it. But before we do that, and this may be, you may find this far-fetched. I don't know that you know this, but I have a PhD from the University of Toronto.
Right. I do know. I looked that up.
I've lived some time in Toronto,
right.
Of course, lots of Canadian friends, and I grew up in Detroit, right across from Windsor, Canada,
right.
And watched CKLW in Windsor, and yep. So Canadians are sort of a part of my background, in a sense,
right.
And there are a lot of, you know, there have been a lot of comparisons between the sort of sensibility of Canadians and Americans. To be really sort of crude about it and stereotypical, Americans, pushy, aggressive, and throw in any other adjectives you like.
Right.
Canadians, well, I remember when I went to graduate school in Canada, I read a book called The Vertical Mosaic,
right,
which spoke a good deal about the formation of the Canadian sensibility and a certain sense of inclusiveness.
Right.
But in a very different way from the melting pot, where you just come to America and you're supposed to just, you know, join in,
right.
Assimilate. And I wonder if there's anything about Christie's Canadian sensibility,
right.
That you might think had an impact on his career.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. I mean, he would have grown up here in London, Ontario, in the late 1800s, early 1900s. It would have been a city of maybe, I don't know, 30,000 or something like that. Probably more than that by the time he leaves, but probably kind of a British heritage-y kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
But still having, just like in the US, immigrants coming there from different parts of Europe. I think that this idea of Canadians sort of being polite and more accommodating in terms of how immigrants would have worked themselves into society. I don't know how much that would have affected him. I know that his roots were Scottish, and he often went in his career, he traveled a lot to Britain and to other parts of Europe to drum up business, to drum up probably support, distribution, all that kinds of things. And I wonder if, in a way, he did that more than others. He seemed to really want to tap into markets beyond North America, and seemingly did. Whether that's his Canadian background that's making him a little more outward looking, I really don't know, but it's an interesting theory.
Yeah. I noticed in your biography, and I think I mentioned this in my New York Sun review of your book, certain adjectives were often used for his films, like clean and polite.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting too. People who go to the movies waiting for Chaplin to be kicked in the pants. An Al Christie film is, as we've already sort of said, in terms of situation comedy, is quite different.
Right. And he was a real believer in it. He would, in his, you know, the studio magazine or in the trade papers, he would often talk about, you're right, the word sort of polite comedies that you can take anybody to. He was a real believer in the idea that women were the ones who made the decisions about what films to go to, and that he felt that was the audience he had to cater to. If he catered to women, he felt that that was going to be a successful move. And his films certainly reflect that to some extent. Often the female characters they're working, or they're in college, or, you know, they have a kind of sense of independence maybe about them. Which I think, again, gives it a little bit more of a modern feel. The other thing, though, is that Sennett was born in Canada, and so...
Yes, yeah, kind
Sennett
of
very theory. Plastic guy, so I'm not sure we can totally put the two together, but yeah. And they were friends and they were colleagues, so it's interesting, too, that... in fact, Sennett, I think, started to move away from slapstick a little bit more in the 20s, and Christie maybe added a little more slapstick in the 20s to his movies. So.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, I watched it on YouTube, the title, maybe you remember. I think it's this Last Sound film about the school teacher who gets involved in a sense in a life of crime.
Right. Half a Sinner or?
Half a Sinner. Yeah, I think it's Half a Sinner. Yeah. That's right. I was very taken with that movie. It's in many ways, one could watch that and say it's a very, very modest movie.
Right.
In other words, there isn't a lot of action. Not huge drama, you know, no car chases.
Right.
It's a very quiet film,
right,
in a way, and yet I remember it so vividly.
Yeah, and he's really, really at the end of his career at that point. And it seems like not a typical movie of his. It's based on a short story by Dalton Trumbo, and I wonder if he, you know, his approach to doing it, like, this is going to be my last film. Is he thinking that?
Mm.
Is he thinking, oh, he was often keen on adapting written materials or stage materials for his films, so that wasn't new. But maybe he just thought, okay, I'm near the end and I'm going to do something a little different and that'll be it. And I'll wrap it up.
Yeah. It's an interesting way, certainly, to end a career for sure.
Yeah.
I thought maybe we should say something about, his treatment of African Americans and African American characters in his work.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, he's a pioneer in many ways. You know, he's literally the first person to be making movies in Hollywood. He's focusing on sitcoms. He's, you know, pushing female actors to the forefront. In the late 20s, as the sound films are coming in, he decides to make a series of black films with black actors, stories that come from, I think, articles in the Saturday Evening Post that were written by a white person. And he decides that for some reason he's going to make these films. And he had done a few films that were, you know, blackface films, which I guess were popular in the 20s with white actors portraying black characters. But he decides that he wants to do this with black actors. And he gets a theater troupe that is well respected. He actually hires a guy by the name of Spencer Williamson, who's a black writer, and has him do some of the screenplay writing, which I think is in some ways kind of pioneering in a way. However, I think the films themselves, when you watch them, and there are a few that are on YouTube, they still have kind of the sort of dialogue that, and the black actors speaking in a way that's sort of playing to white audiences. So they are, and he's been, you know, some others have written about him saying they're, you know, they are stereotypical. And,
yes.
You know, while it's maybe admirable in the sense that he is giving black actors and at least one black writer work and promoting the films, they're still not what I would call things that you would maybe look back now with pride in any way.
Sure.
You know, they are stereotypical, but at the same time, they seem to have been fairly successful. I think he was going for a black audience, which maybe a lot of other directors weren't even thinking about. I think in some ways he probably did it because he thought he could make some money.
Sure.
From it. And I talk about a few of the movies in my book, and it's interesting that when you go on YouTube and people have comments below, some of the comments are actually sort of praising the characters. There's a female character in one of the movies who's, you know, sort of very sassy and doesn't take anything from anybody. And I can remember seeing a comment, somebody saying, "Oh, it's nice to see a strong black woman from a movie in the late 1920s." So. It's kind of an interesting part of his career, and he doesn't do it for very long, and I'm not sure it really worked out, but it is, in a sense, pioneering in its own way.
Well, and it's sort of typical of his he was very entrepreneurial.
Yes.
And innovative in the sense that he was looking at his audience. He was thinking about what the opportunities were in the medium, the way to frame a film and so on. I think it makes him, both from, in a sense, an aesthetic, but also a business point of view, a very interesting study in the way in which motion pictures developed.
Yeah. And he seems to be, it's the more you hear about him, I guess the more I found out about him, the more I kept saying to myself, so why is he not so well known when he keeps doing these kind of what seemingly are innovative things? I think part of it is because he was such a fan of short films. He did make features, and some of them did quite well, Charlie's Aunt being probably the most successful, is that he somehow gets overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he doesn't have that sort of two big really famous films or famous actors or actresses that are connected to him that make us remember him.
I also wonder if he was prolific. He did so much film.
Yeah.
That if in some sense the quantity overwhelms the quality.
Yeah, I wonder about that too. I mean, I've seen a lot of his films. I think some of them are really, really good. I think some of them are okay. He certainly did churn them out. I mean, overall, he was involved in more than 1,000 films in his 30 year or so career. Most of them, the sort of 10-minute, 20-minute kinds of movies that were popular at the time. I don't know. I think there's an expectation on his part that I have to meet my audience's need.
Yeah.
That meant 25 films a year or whatever it was. and he was not always the director in the 20s.
Right.
He became more of a producer. But he had good directors as well. So it's still a puzzle to me in some ways.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to mention about your book that I admired, and it was in terms of biographical form,
right,
is the way you handle your sources. So often, and I say this in my New York Sun Review, biographers, there are different schools about how you should handle a biographical narrative. And one school of thought is make it as much like a novel as you can.
Right.
And part of what that means is you bury virtually all of your sources in the notes, the end notes at the back of the book.
Right.
And you make it look like, I think, in a sense, you make it look like it's all, you know, just a story that you've written.
Right.
And it's tremendously powerful, certainly,
yes,
to do a biography that way. On the other hand, it's a kind of, it's not dishonest, that's a little too harsh to say, but it's masking what biography in a sense is, which is bits and pieces and fragments and things you put together and sources that look good, but then they're not so good actually when you look at them, and other sources, you know, you decide to rely on them. And why is it that you rely on them? Often that whole story of biography never gets told. And it's the story that does get told in your book.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for your review. I appreciated that what you had to say about the book. I think part of the approach comes from my journalistic background. You know, I'm used to, you know, interviewing people and telling people who said these things. I'm used to, disclosing the sources in the body of the work, rather than putting them at the end of a story. So that's, I think, one of the main reasons that I wrote it in that style, the journalistic, more of a journalistic, upfront, here are the sources kind of style. The other thing is I kind of toyed with the idea to some extent to write it in the way that you described, the sort of more of a novel way. And in the opening chapter, I decided that I didn't want to start at the beginning. I wanted to sort of start in the middle. to give people right away a sense of who Al Christie was and how successful he was. And so in the first chapter, I kind of try it a little bit that way by setting out this character, Al Christie, who's kind of getting at the top of his game and doing well, and how did he get here and what are some of the things he's doing?
Right.
As a way to kind of draw the readers in into it. But one of the things in terms of the research was that I was not able to find much from about Christie, either through letters or a journal or things that he left behind that would have given me maybe a little more insight into his inner thoughts, so to
yes.
speak. There just doesn't seem to be any of that. And again, I talked to another sort of distant relative of his who said, yeah, we don't have anything, as far as she knows, of any kind of letters or things that he sent. And so in a way, it was disappointing because I wanted to know more about his personal life. And I did have, I do have a couple of chapters that focus mostly on his personal life. But in a way, I wish I'd had more. And if I'd had more, maybe I would have, at least for part of the book, taken a slightly different approach. Maybe a little bit more of that novelistic approach, but
yeah.
I'm always a little leery of that. How do yeah. I really know what he was thinking or doing or saying? Or something?
Right. You make a very good point. In biography, often the way a biography gets written often does depend on the quantity, quality, and nature of your sources.
Right. Right.
And often the biographies people really like is like Quest for Corvo, where you know, the subject is very hard to pin down, and it's really about the biographical quest. People right. really love that, but what that kind of book really is making a virtue of necessity. You know, you don't have the sources, so you've got to talk about yourself
right.
and how you obtained this material.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting is in biographies of actors, of movie figures, some have been writers like David Niven, although the interesting yeah. thing about David Niven is a lot of what he writes isn't true.
Right.
It's very entertaining, but when you start to look at it, it doesn't hold up.
Right.
The interesting thing is, for instance, I've just finished this biography of Ronald Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
And to begin with, I was kind of fooled by some of the articles about him. The more I learned about him, the more I realized he didn't give very many interviews.
Right.
And that there were people in movie magazines, especially, I sort of knew this, but I know a lot more about it now, is they were very frustrated by his not being willing to really be forthright and talk about himself. And so they just made it up.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's one of the things in my book that, you know, I rely to some extent on Christie's interviews with other publications, or specifically the Christie Comedies publication that they put out, where we have, you know, here's this thing by Al Christie talking about something. And I always was wondering, well, did Al really write this, or was it his publicity guy?
Yeah.
How much of this is Al? And so even then in the book, I would kind of say, well, this says that Al Christie did this and thought this and whatever. It was good because he didn't seem to be shy about talking about the movie making process, why he made the kinds of movies he did, what audiences thought about it, what critics thought about it, that kind of thing. Was all kinds of material there. In his personal life, it was very hard to find out what he was like as a person, other than sort of second or third hand comments, usually from actors who were interviewed by somebody else, silent film actors, later in their life.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a part in the book where, you know, Al's young daughter dies tragically in a horse riding accident. And I couldn't find anything that would tell me how that affected him, other than a couple of actors saying, you know, he wasn't quite the same after that.
Yeah.
But he kept working. I think he just threw himself into work because he didn't seem to miss a beat in that particular year. He just went on with his work. And I mean, he was married twice. and divorced twice. And there's a little bit of information about that too. But it's getting a handle on somebody and their personal life is a challenge. And it certainly was with him. And I think I've got as much as I could, but it would have been nice to have more.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So is there anything I should have asked you that you wanted to talk about?
I guess maybe one of the things I'd like to talk about was perhaps just his nature, his sense of what he seemed to think was funny and important, and how he almost, it seems, tirelessly promoted it. He never stopped talking about how short films were really the main reason Hollywood was successful. You know, he kept going on about how, especially in the 20s, all these people were making serious films and they're long and the audience doesn't really want those. They come to see the short comedies and that's really what they're all about. It's almost he has blinders on, whereby he's so committed to short films that he never gets away from it. I mean, in the last sort of decade of his career, he's in the, you know, he goes bankrupt because of the Depression.
Right.
He goes to New York and becomes this director for hire for educational films, making short comedies. That's his bread and butter. And he basically, other than a couple of ones near the end of his career, he pretty much sticks to that sort of 20, 24 minute format. And he has, you know, it's the talking period is kind of interesting because he's got these people, he's working with Buster Keaton.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of films. Buster's Keaton's sort of gone down. And so he's now making short films with Al Christie as the director. People coming up like Bob Hope and Danny Kaye and Bert Lahr. He makes all these films with these people on their way up. And it never reflects really onto him. Again, even though they made a big name, it's not attached to sort of, well, it was because they started with Al Christie. So,
you know, it reminds me sort of like, say, short story writers who usually don't get as well known as novelists.
Right.
And often short story writers write one or two novels because they feel they have to. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's like the feature film. Right. You know, if you don't do the novel, you're never going to quite make it in terms of reputation. Yeah. So this idea of sticking to the short film, even though others are making some short films too, but I mean, Chaplin and Keaton certainly are known for some of their longer feature films and masterpieces like The General, for example, or The Gold Rush isn't really a long feature film, but they're known for those kinds of signature films. Yeah. Whereas he was, you know, he was the master of a genre, and the popularity of such genres waxes and wanes.
Right.
And that may be part of the result of us not hearing about him. Although, you know, now with your biography, people will hear about
it. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, one of the things that I've done recently is that he, Al Christie has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame and has since 1960. And his brother Charles, who ran the studio, the financial side, also has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. But here in Canada, there's nothing. There's nothing here in London that I'm aware of. There is a Canadian Walk of Fame that's in Toronto, and they have people nominated sort of every year. And so I've sent them off a nomination, basically saying, you know, we need to know about this Al Christie person who was such a big deal in Hollywood and deserves his own star in Canada as he already has one in Hollywood.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I hope you're successful with that nomination.
Yeah, I'm going to see what happens. I mean, I've gotten a little bit of media coverage on it, so I'm just going to see how that plays out, and I hope that something will happen with that, and that also that he gets maybe more recognition in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, I hope there can be something of a revival or something. that just people get, because of the book, they get to know about this person and what he did and how important he was in the history of movies.
Well, there's enough surviving material, certainly, for an El Christie Film Festival.
Well, yeah, and they did a thing at the Niles Silent Film Museum in California. A weekend of Christie films with some people talking about him and the movies themselves. And I got a chance to do that on Zoom. It was during the pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I think he's starting to get, at least among sort of the silent film fan world, he's starting to get a little more attention. I'm going to be going to the Columbus Moving Picture Film Festival at the end of May in Columbus, Ohio. To talk about Christie, do a presentation on him. So I'm hoping there'll be more of that kind of thing as well.
It sounds great.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I hope that people will, look into Al Christie and find out more about him.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, Mark, and, I think you did a wonderful book, and I'm hoping that after I post this link, you'll get even more readers.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carl. I really appreciate it, and I will certainly spread the word at my end about this podcast.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you, Carl.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye.